Hello, and welcome back to Weird on the Rocks. This is a podcast that explores the weird, unusual, strange, and unexplained, all while getting our drink on. I'm your host, Katie. So today's episode is going to cover a story that I'm sure most of you are familiar with, or at least have heard of, and that is the story of the death of Lacey Peterson. This happened on Christmas Eve of 2002, and it was a huge story at the time that captured the attention of the entire country. Lacey was a beautiful, young, and pregnant woman who was, by all descriptions, a very fun and caring and just sweet, good person. And her husband, Scott, was a handsome, you know, guy's guy, just a normal couple. And together they made this attractive, middle-class, kind of all-American family that a lot of people could relate to. When Lacey went missing, the story became a national headline with the media camped outside their home 24/7 and pictures of Lacey plastered all over the news and magazines. This case was really the height of the 24-hour news cycle that we see now with cases like this. But although the story garnered a lot of attention, like a lot of other big cases in our society, there are still a lot of lesser known facts about this case that the media just didn't present accurately. I feel like with these types of cases, the media chooses what they want to show and they pick a narrative and they stick to it and they really try to drive that home. And it isn't always rooted in 100% fact. There's a lot of rumor and speculation with cases like this. I was 13 when this happened, and I definitely remember seeing this everywhere. I remember my mom talking about it, and I just remember thinking how pretty Lacey was and that it was really sad what had happened to her. But, you know, I was a kid. I didn't fully grasp exactly what was going on. Then in 2012, the book and later the movie Gone Girl by author Gillian Flynn came out, and I read the book like a lot of us, and I was really captivated by the story. And I remember while I was reading it, I thought that the story sounded really familiar. And it turns out that the author loosely based her book off of the Lacey and Scott Peterson story. And this kind of reopened the case for me in my mind, and I began doing some of my own research. In doing so, I found a lot of information that I was totally unaware of, and I think most people are. So although this story is kind of overdone at this point, and a lot of podcasts and YouTube videos have covered it, I still thought it would be interesting and important to do an episode on it and maybe shine some light on the story and some of the lesser known details. I also thought this would be an appropriate time to cover this because there are some new developments currently happening with Scott Peterson's prison sentence, and the entire case is kind of back in the spotlight and in people's minds right now. I'm the type of person where if a topic intrigues me, I don't mind hearing multiple people cover it, and I enjoy hearing differing perspectives and opinions. So hopefully you'll still appreciate hearing this episode, even if you are super familiar with this case. You can find Weird on the Rocks on Facebook and Instagram at Weird on the Rocks Podcast, Twitter at Weird_Rocks, and the website weirdontherocks.weebly.com. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts and subscribe wherever you're listening now. Before we get into the good stuff, I want to share this week's beverage of choice. I'm being super lame right now, and I'm just drinking some good old limeade, and I put a little sparkling water in it to kind of dilute it because that stuff is very sweet. And then I also put some maraschino cherry juice into it just to kind of jazz it up. As I mentioned in the last episode, I am pregnant, so I can't drink any alcohol right now. And I've been drinking a lot of lemonade and limeade. I've been craving sour stuff. So this is kind of like a cocktail. I'm telling myself it is. It's actually really good, though. So I hope you guys are out there enjoying a drink for me. And I'm there with you in spirit. I really am. All right, well, let's get into it. Cheers, and let's get weird.
Thank you.
Lacey Denise Rocha was born on May 4th, 1975 to Sharon and Dennis Rocha, in early years living on her family's farm in Escalon, California. Lacey had one brother named Brent, who was 4 years older. Lacey enjoyed working around the farm and developed a love for the outdoors, especially plants and gardening. When Lacey and Brent were young, their parents Sharon and Dennis divorced, and Sharon moved with the two kids to Modesto, California, a city of 200,000, much larger than their previous rural town. Eventually, both Sharon and Dennis would remarry, and Lacey would be joined by step and half-siblings. In school, Lacey was well-liked and participated in cheerleading and had lots of friends. After high school, she attended Cal Poly State University in San Luis Obispo, where she studied ornamental horticulture, which the site study.com defines as, quote, "Ornamental horticulture is the study of growing, arranging, and tending decorative plants and flowers. Studies in ornamental horticulture explore methods for designing plant and flower displays that can be used by golf courses, greenhouses, and public or private businesses," end quote. Lacey continued to enjoy plants and gardening, and sunflowers were her favorite flower. While attending Cal Poly, Lacey met Scott Peterson through a mutual friend. Lacey was not one to hold back and made the first move by giving him her phone number. Soon after meeting, Lacey called her mom, Sharon, and told her that she had just met the man she was going to marry. And the two soon began dating. For their first date, Scott, who loved fishing and the ocean, took Lacey deep sea fishing, where she proceeded to get extremely seasick. Scott, who was a skilled golfer and even played with pro golfer Phil Mickelson, decided to put his dreams of going pro on the back burner and instead focused on getting a more practical degree and began studying agricultural business at Cal Poly. After 2 years of dating, the couple moved in together. Lacey graduated with her degree in ornamental horticulture and began her first job. Scott had one more year of college and soon graduated with a degree in agricultural business. On August 9, 1997, the couple were married at Sycamore Mineral Springs Resort in San Luis Obispo. Now that they were married college graduates, the happy couple bought and opened a sports bar in San Luis Obispo called The Shack. After a few years, they decided to sell the bar and moved back to Lacey's hometown of Modesto. And in 2000, they purchased their first home, a 3-bed, 2-bath bungalow. Lacey began a job as a substitute teacher, and Scott began working for TradeCorp USA, a subsidiary of a European fertilizer company. Lacey enjoyed being a wife and kept a very clean home. She loved to decorate, host parties, and cook. At the beginning of their relationship, Lacey and Scott both told family and friends that they did not want to have children, but eventually they changed their minds. And in 2002, they announced that Lacey was pregnant with their first child, a boy that they were planning to name Connor. By all accounts, Scott and Lacey were both excited about the pregnancy and decorated Connor's nursery with a nautical theme. But things for this happy all-American family would all change on Christmas Eve of 2002. The following is a timeline of the day that was provided by Scott to the Modesto police. Scott said that morning, Lacey woke up around 7:30 a.m. and had cereal because she was 8 months pregnant and tended to get nauseous if she didn't eat upon waking. He stayed in bed a bit longer and got up around 8 a.m. Lacey was cleaning the house, including mopping, and the two briefly watched Martha Stewart on TV. Lacey was going to take the dog for a walk and do some last-minute holiday things around the house, so Scott thought he would go golfing. He then realized it was cold out and decided to go fishing instead. Around 9:20 a.m., a neighbor saw Scott loading several large umbrellas into his truck, and he waved and said hello to her. Around 9:30, he left the home and drove to his work warehouse, which was about 3 miles from their home. This warehouse is where Scott kept his fishing boat, tools, woodworking equipment, and the computer that he used for work. Computer history from this computer shows that around 10:30 a.m., someone was using the computer to check emails, send email, and research how to put together a piece of woodworking equipment that Scott had just received in the mail. Scott said he then hooked up his boat to his truck and drove the hour and a half drive to the Berkeley Marina, When asked what kind of fish he was fishing for that day, Scott said he didn't really know, as fishing was a new hobby for him. Meanwhile, back in Modesto, where Lacey was, neighbor Karen Service sees the Petersons' golden retriever, Mackenzie, walking down the street with his leash still on. She put him in the Petersons' backyard and shut the gate. By 12:54 p.m., Scott had arrived at the marina and purchased a parking pass. From 1 to 2 p.m., Scott was out on the water. At 2:15, Scott leaves the marina and calls Lacey. She does not answer, so he leaves the following message. Quote, "Hey, beautiful, I just left a message at home. It's 2:15 and I'm leaving Berkeley. I won't be able to get to Vela Farms to get that basket for Papa. I was hoping you would get this message and go on out there. I'll see you in a bit, sweetie. Love you. Bye." End quote. At 4:30 p.m., Scott drops his boat back off at his warehouse, then arrives home around 4:45 p.m. He first notices that the front door is unlocked and Mackenzie is in the backyard with his leash still on. Lacey is not home and her car is in the driveway. At this point, Scott assumes that Lacey was at her mom's and that she had picked her up, something that was not uncommon. Scott said he threw out the dirty mop water that was still in the bucket and put his clothes in the wash because they smelled from fishing. He then ate a leftover piece of pizza and a glass of milk and took a shower. By 5:17 p.m., Scott was getting worried that he hadn't heard from Lacey and decided to call her mother, Sharon, assuming she was with her. Sharon said she was not, and Scott told her that the dog and Lacey's car were home, but she wasn't. At 5:47 p.m., Lacey's stepfather calls 911 and says, quote, "My son-in-law called. My daughter's been missing since this morning. She's 8 months pregnant. She took her dog for a walk in the park. The dog came back with just the leash on." End quote. By 6 p.m., the Modesto police had arrived at the Peterson home. Detective Brocchini immediately searched the Peterson home and found all doors and windows to be locked. No evidence of forced entry and no evidence of a struggle. Detective Bueller then joined Detective Brocchini in the investigation. Bueller explained that they both had concerns about Scott from the beginning and found that he wasn't acting how they expected a spouse of a missing pregnant woman to behave. Bueller said that at one point he put a glass down on the coffee table, and Scott immediately came over and put a coaster under it. He also said that while looking inside of Lacey's car in the garage, he accidentally opened the car door into Scott's car door, and Scott rushed over and started wiping away the mark that it had left. At midnight in the early hours of Christmas morning, Scott was interviewed by Detective Brocchini at the Modesto Police Department. Scott was cooperative and gave his timeline of the previous day. When asked if he remembered what Martha Stewart was talking about on TV, Scott recalled that she was making meringue. During this interview, he also provided his parking receipt from the Berkeley Marina. Detective Brocchini asked personal questions, including if he and Lacey were having any marital problems, to which Scott said no. Brocchini asked Scott, quote, "So what you're telling me, Scott, is you have no idea where Lacey is," end quote. To which Scott replied, quote, "I do not," end quote. About this interview, Detective Bueller would later say, quote, "I gotta tell you, I was really expecting more from him. I was expecting him to ask, what have you been doing? Is this a priority?" So his behavior was just a little different from other people we had dealt with. He just didn't seem to be as interested in what we were doing, end quote. In a later interview, Scott would say that he felt as though Detective Brocchini was zeroing in on him from the very beginning. Scott was asked to take a polygraph test, to which he agreed, but the next day declined after speaking with his parents. Detective Bueller said that he and Brocchini began feeling more suspicious of Scott because of this, and were beginning to see him as uncooperative. On December 26th, Modesto Chief of Police Roy Wasden held a press conference. He gave information about Lacey, that she was a 27-year-old Caucasian female with brown hair and brown eyes, standing 5 feet 1 inches tall, and was 8 months pregnant. He also said she was wearing white long-sleeve shirt and black pants, and had a sunflower tattoo on her ankle. Wasden also told the media that they had already interviewed Scott Peterson, who gave an alibi of being gone fishing at the time of Lacey's disappearance. Immediately following the press conference, the press began scrutinizing Scott's alibi, saying that it was too easy of an out for him to have been fishing alone on the day before a holiday when most people are at home. That same day, Modesto police, as well as the community, began searching for Lacey on foot, horseback, and by boat. A community headquarters was set up at a local hotel where volunteers worked by distributing flyers and answering phone calls. A $125,000 reward was announced. Numerous people called in saying that they saw Lacey walking the dog on the morning of December 24th. These eyewitness reports were given to the police, but none of these people were ever followed up with. The same day as the press conference and the community headquarters being established, Detectives Brocchini and Bueller once again visited the Peterson residence to conduct another search. Scott was asked to sign a document agreeing to the search, and he called his attorney to seek counsel. His attorney was out of the office and took a while to get back to Scott, so the police began searching the home anyway without his consent. Detective Bueller later admitted that this search was less about finding evidence and more about gauging Scott's behavior and demeanor while they searched the house. He also said that he and Detective Brocchini both found it suspicious that Scott didn't approve the search and wanted to speak to his attorney. Out of this search also came a rumor that the home smelled of bleach, something that would be later brought up in this case. However, there is nothing in the police report of the home smelling like any cleaning ingredients, and no police officers have ever confirmed that they smelled bleach. By the next day, the media had caught wind of the story and dozens of camera crews set up shop outside the Peterson home. People were instantly hooked by the story of the beautiful, young, pregnant woman who disappeared from a normal American town. Lacey's mother and brother appeared on the local news begging for whoever took Lacey to bring her home and that they loved her. Scott did not make any public statements. Soon, the media joined the police in their suspicions and concerns about Scott's behavior. He seemingly appeared to carry on with his normal life, such as taking out the trash and taking the dog for walks. To many, this looked like a man who wasn't worried about his missing wife and unborn child. He was described by many as aloof. People wanted to see a man distraught and filled with emotion. Instead, they saw a stoic man who kept his emotions to himself. Scott's family came to his defense, saying that Scott was purposely trying to stay strong and was a private person in general. He believed that being overly emotional or dramatic might put more attention on him and take the spotlight away from the search for Lacey and Connor. Scott also felt a target on his back by both law enforcement, the media, and the community, and didn't want to give in to the sensationalism. On December 30th, the Modesto police held another press conference, telling the public that a home burglary had occurred directly across the street from the Peterson home on the morning of Christmas Eve, the same time they believe Lacey went missing. Witness Diane Jackson stated that she saw several suspicious men standing in front of the home, gathered around a white van. When she drove by, they all stopped what they were doing and looked at her, which gave her an unsettling feeling. She later heard through the neighborhood that the family who lived in the home was out of town at the time and came home to find their home burglarized. Diane, who was watching the news, realized that this was the same morning that Lacey Peterson disappeared, so she called and made a police report. The following day, both Lacey and Scott's family spoke with the media. They vocalized that they believed the burglary was connected to Lacey's disappearance. Lacey's mother, brother, and stepfather were all very visibly upset, begging whoever took her to bring her home safely. They also said that Lacey was the type to get involved when she saw something wrong happening, and she would have confronted the men if she witnessed the burglary. And about this burglary, Nancy Grace, well-known television commentator who covered the story from the very beginning, said, quote, "There are no coincidences in criminal law," end quote. After the press conference aired, the media yet again pointed out that Lacey's family was obviously emotional and distraught, which was something they were still waiting to see from Scott himself. Nancy Grace said, quote, "I don't know what it was about Scott. He just rubbed me the wrong way. There was just something about him. He didn't seem genuine. He seemed kind of cocky. I couldn't understand why the rest of her family was begging for help, but her husband wasn't begging for help, end quote. But in return, many defended Scott, saying that there are no rules for how people grieve and that nobody knows how they would react or behave in a situation like this. Within 2 days of the information of the burglary being made public, two men were apprehended and arrested for the crime. Steve Todd and Glenn Pierce admitted to burglarizing the home, but both were adamant that they had nothing to do with the disappearance of Lacey Peterson. Police also found no connection between the burglary and what happened to Lacey. After their arrest, Modesto police announced that the burglary had actually happened on December 26th. Not December 24th, 2 days after Lacey went missing, so there was no way that the two men were responsible. However, many did not buy this information. News reporter Ted Rollins explained that he, along with other news reporters, were outside the Peterson home at all hours on December 26th. He was very firm in his belief that if several men broke into the home right across the street, they would have seen it, and undoubtedly believed that the burglary took place on the original believed date of December 24th, the same morning Lacey went missing. Lacey's family and Scott also still believed that Lacey's disappearance was connected to this burglary. In a local news interview, Lacey's mother, brother, and stepfather were asked if they believed Scott had anything to do with his missing wife, to which they said no. They reiterated that they loved and trusted Scott and did not believe he was involved. However, this was all about to change. Detective Brocchini received a phone call from a woman who claimed that she was in a romantic relationship with Scott Peterson. Her name was Amber Fry. Amber explained that she had been dating Scott for only about 2 months, and he told her that he was not married. However, she had seen a story about Lacey in the newspaper and realized that her new boyfriend was the husband of this missing pregnant woman. Detective Brocchini, who was already suspicious of Scott, admitted that he was relieved when Amber came forward because he now felt like he had enough evidence to make Scott a person of interest. Amber Fry was a 27-year-old single mom to an 18-month-old little girl. She had just graduated from massage school and was working as a massage therapist. Amber was looking to find a husband and settle down, and was excited when a friend told her about a man that she had met at a work convention. The man was Scott Peterson. The two exchanged phone numbers and soon began a romantic relationship. Scott said that he was not married and wanted to get married someday, but did not want any children. Then, after a few weeks of dating, Scott told Amber that he had been untruthful and that he had been married, but he, quote, lost his wife, end quote, and would be spending his first holidays without her. Amber wanted to respect Scott and did not push the issue any further. After Amber called the Modesto police and revealed this information, she agreed to help in their investigation by recording her phone conversations with Scott. She said that although this made her extremely nervous and uncomfortable, she wanted to do it for Lacey. On December 30th, the Modesto community held a candlelight vigil for Lacey and Connor in a local park. Hundreds of people showed up and members of Lacey's family spoke. Once again, Scott did not speak. The media captured a photo of Scott with his young niece, smiling at her, and another photo of him standing with an older man and woman and laughing. Some viewed this as normal. Many believed that Scott could be grieving the loss of his wife while also enjoying a moment with his friends and family, and it didn't mean that he didn't care. But others saw this as extremely problematic, and that a normal person wouldn't be smiling at the vigil for his missing wife and unborn child. Also, while at this vigil, Scott made a phone call to Amber Fry. As with all of their phone calls at this point, it was recorded. The background was noisy with people talking, and Scott told Amber that he was in Paris with friends, celebrating the new year under the Eiffel Tower. Amber, who knew that Scott was in Modesto, played along and asked questions about who he was with, to which Scott gave the name of several fictitious friends. In a later jailhouse phone call between Scott and his father, his dad asked him why he continued to talk to Amber after Lacey went missing. Scott said, quote, "The overriding reason through it all was if she starts giving media interviews, there is no more search for Lacey and Connor. I had just seen what had happened to the search for Chandra Levy with Gary Condit. As soon as it was revealed that he had sex with her, there was no more search for her. Every hour I could buy to keep the search going. This is all solved if I bring Lacey and Connor home," end quote. Around this time, Modesto Police Sergeant Ed Steele was assigned to cover Scott and act as personal protection for him. He said that upon first meeting, Scott seemed very charming, but did not act how a grieving husband would normally act. Steele remembers visiting the volunteer center and finding Scott eating ribs. He stood up and said, quote, "Hey Ed, check this out," end quote, and showed him a huge rib dripping with barbecue sauce. Ed thought it was odd and overly joyous behavior for someone literally sitting at the volunteer center that was working to find his missing wife. On January 2nd, 2003, with Lacey missing for 9 days, the Modesto police held another press conference. Here, they showed a large printed photo of Scott's truck and fishing boat, believing that they were used in Lacey's disappearance, and urging the public to call in if they had seen Scott driving this truck or his boat on December 24th. Scott and his family were confused by this, as he had already explained to the police that he definitely drove his truck and boat to the marina that day to go fishing. Scott's dad said, quote, "He has a receipt to show he was at the marina during those times. What more do you need?" end quote. The police also came out with their belief that Lacey didn't know about Scott's fishing boat, which he had bought in cash for $1,400 about a month before her disappearance. However, two different witnesses who owned adjacent warehouses both stated that they had seen Lacey at the warehouse just the day before her disappearance, and one even let her use their bathroom. So there was no way he could have hidden an entire boat from her. During this time, law enforcement continued their searches for Lacey and also conducted several dive searches in the Berkeley Marina where Scott had been fishing that day. They also conducted a search of Scott's fishing boat and warehouse. In the warehouse, they found a pair of pliers with a dark hair wrapped around the jaws. The hair was analyzed and found to not belong to Scott and was consistent with Lacey's hair but could not be confirmed to be hers. Some believed this meant that Scott had somehow used those pliers on Lacey in some way, while others saw this as a harmless detail and expected to find Lacey's hair around his warehouse, his vehicle, and their home. 21 days after Lacey had gone missing, the Modesto Police Department received news that the National Enquirer, a tabloid newspaper, had information about Scott's affair with Amber Fry, and they were going to go public with it. Detective Brocchini and Bueller sat down with Lacey's mother to break the news and showed her the photo the newspaper was planning on publishing, a photo of Scott and Amber together at a Christmas party. Lacey's mother broke down in tears and said, quote, "But why did he have to kill her?" end quote. Soon after, the Modesto police held another press conference. Nobody knew what this meeting was about, and the room was filled to the brim with media. Out walked Amber Fry, a tall, slender woman with blonde hair. Reporters who were present in the room said the confusion amongst the crowd was palpable. Who was this person, and why was she speaking instead of the police? Through a shaky voice, Amber explained who she was and that she had a romantic relationship with Scott Peterson and did not know he was married. With tears in her eyes, Amber said, quote, "I am very sorry for Lacey's family and the pain that this has caused them, and I pray for her safe return as well," end quote. Immediately, the press went crazy with the revelation that Scott had a secret mistress. While some believed that this proved absolutely nothing and was not connected to Lacey's disappearance, the majority of the media and public saw this as confirmation that Scott had done something to Lacey. Overnight, Scott Peterson became the most hated man in America. Okay, so that's going to be it for today's episode. Part 2 of the Lacey Peterson story will be out in 2 weeks, where I will discuss the rest of the case, including the evidence, the trial, and what is happening with Scott Peterson now. Like I said at the beginning, I know that this case has been covered a lot over the years, but I hope that even if you know a lot about it, that you still enjoyed my coverage on it and hopefully even learned some new information. As always, thank you for taking the time out of your day to join me. I appreciate all of you. And until next time, cheers and stay weird.
That was a Titancast episode.